stuckness can be physiological, but stuckness, the mythology is that it's our identity. We know brains aren't like that. Brains aren't static. Biting into a really sour lemon when you're procrastinating will disrupt your autopilot settings for probably about 2 to 3 seconds, just long enough for a choice window to open for you to do something else.
What is the role of motivation in this kind of movement?
This idea that we have to feel something to do something is a myth that keeps us perpetually stuck.
The whole construct of mental illness necessarily shifts.
What we call mental illness is often a reasonable response to the chaotic nature of living with access to everyone everywhere.
How you think about stuckness, what it actually represents.
The glib answer is
Hi, and welcome back to Reclamation Radio. I am Dr. Kelly Brogan, and today I sit down with neuropsychotherapist Britt Frank, who is the author of The Science of Stuck and Align Your Mind, and a fellow parts work enthusiast. We talk all things stuckness, from feeling trapped in a situation as dramatic as domestic violence, all the way to just a disconnection from inspiration and not knowing what direction to go in your life. We look at addiction and explore how it could possibly be that addiction, including to what she calls addiction to people-shaped substances, maybe isn't actually a problem at all. We also talk about why motivation isn't necessary for change and action, and a lot of the misconceptions around motivation. And you may learn why biting on a lemon is the procrastination remedy. Enjoy. Welcome, Britt, to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
I am so delighted that our paths have crossed, because as I've learned more about your work, there's just bullet point after bullet point after bullet point where we have come to the same conclusions. And we have walked, I think there's probably been some overlap, but we have walked very different journeys, you know, and both have found ourselves in the practitioner clinician seat, somehow working on our own wounds through the professional lens, which is, you know, often how it is. And I sometimes think like I became a psychiatrist so that I can have really regimented boundaries, like the session starts on the minute, ends on the minute, because I couldn't muster those like in my actual lived experience. So there's so much that professionalizing your own, you know, traumas and struggles and difficulties can confer. But then there's a certain point where, yeah, you realize that that much like your patients. So I would love to unpack this journey. And I was telling you offline, I don't often ask on the show, you know, tell me about your story, tell me about yourself, because there's usually something that I want in the juicy bits of your work to convey, right? Because you have, you know, a workbook and a book, and you have put out there incredible resources, and people may or may not get around to them. And I want them to get a flavor for what it is that you have to offer. And the subject that you speak most about is very near and dear to my heart, because I've come to identify this exact same subject as like the core of suffering, and it's stuckness, right? So this Sisyphusian boulder up the mountain over and over and over again forever, hellscape. It really is a hellscape. And I want to start, just dive right in, and we'll weave in, you know, your personal credentials as we go. But I want to dive right in because I think a lot about this concept, and I want you to share your perspective on stuckness. And if you think that it is a perspective issue, if you think that it's like a physiologic state, you know, or if you think it's just a stage, like a phase that's necessary to go through as we grow and develop, or how do you characterize it? Because I think even the word, most of us are with you, right? Like we have some arena in our lives where it just, the inertia is like a silent scream, or maybe it's more comprehensive. You know, I have even girlfriends who are in their 50s who feel like this is their primary, has no major crises or cataclysms, but it's just a sense of the existential quicksand that they're in. So maybe let's just start with how you think about stuckness. Like what are your conclusions as far as what it actually represents?
So the answer, the glib answer, is all of the above. It can be all of the things, some of the things, or none. So my disclaimer first is that when I'm talking about any kind of stuckness, I am not referring to oppression. I am not referring to enslavement. Assuming that you have choices is the type of stuckness to which my work focuses. If you don't have any choices at all, and that's not always the case. I mean, it's very rarely the case that we have no choices. Sometimes stuck is code for I don't like my choice points and I don't want to do any of the things, but that's not the same as being stuck. So disclaimer, all of my work assumes you have relative safety, which means you have access to at least a few choices and you have your basic needs met. So with those caveats in place, stuckness can be physiological, especially if you are given chemicals and told they'll help you, but what they're doing is making things worse. Or if you're not given chemicals that you need and being told you're fine. So there is a physiology component. But I find that stuckness, the mythology, is that it's our identity. This is just who I am. And we know brains aren't like that. Brains aren't static. So stuckness can very quickly become a very unpleasant, uncomfortable, but familiar blanket. And we know brains don't like change. All change, even good change, is going to initially register as threatening. And so I'll speak for myself. I'm stuck was a wonderfully convenient excuse for my own inertia. I could have done things different. I didn't want to because I was comfortable in the chaos. It was like a warm weight blanket I wrapped around myself.
I have taken a hard look at the semantics and the spell casting that we engage in, even in my own life. So the I can'ts or I have to's that pepper this landscape of stuckness. And I want to kind of double click on what you said about choices, because a lot of folks imagine that they don't have choices, right? Like they might say in the affirmative to your opening position, right? They might say, well, I'm one of those people. I actually don't have choices. I'm out of money. I can't get a job. I am stuck in this relationship, even though it's abusive. You know, there are many different ways that you can feel paralyzed by all of the potential paths being blocked at the outset. But my sense is you are suggesting that not only do those choices exist and you just don't prefer them, but there are actually these micro yeses, right? There are these tiny choices. There are these little steps that exist even between the big arcs that we contemplate as we are considering what the rest of our life or even the next chapter might look like. So how would you help somebody determine like what the existing choices even are if they feel like, well, I don't have any? And that's not actually true. It's an illusion.
It's an illusion for a lot of people. So I would say, let's just start with the assumption that you have them. So if someone says to me, I have no choices, I would say, well, we're starting with the assumption that you have at least one. And I have been in a situation where I had no money and no job and was actively being abused in a domestic violence situation. So I have a lot of compassion for the dilemma. I'm not sitting here being like, oh, just leave. If that was easy enough to just leave an abusive environment, we all would. And podcasts wouldn't exist and we wouldn't need books and therapists and all the things. So I have a lot of compassion for the dilemma. However, I had choices. I did not like them. So when you have no money and no job, it might be that you don't have the amount of money that you want or the amount of money that you need to leave the relationship. Fine. And it might be you don't have the skill set for the job that would then afford you the money, which then means what skills do you need? I also didn't want to do, and I ended up waitressing because I didn't want to, but I could. And I was able to scrape together money doing that. And so you may not be able to get a job that you are happy to discuss at cocktail parties. Is it that you can't get a job or is it that you don't like the jobs that you can get? Is it that you have no money or is it that you're not willing to look at your finances and the financial options? So micro yeses are, we have to make the choices not only there, but manageable. Because if you said to me, your choices are to stay or to go, that's too big. Brains don't like big. Too much, too fast, that's trauma, according to Dr. Peter Levine. Too much, too fast, too soon is his definition of trauma. So, okay, how much money would it take for me to live leaving this abusive relationship? What job skills would I need to do a thing? And then where are the people, places, and resources where that might be available? You might not be able to do all the things, but is it really the case that you can't do any? That's very rarely true.
And to even mobilize in the direction of these small steps, these baby steps or micro yeses, would you say that you have to already have chosen, right? So if you're available to go into your experience, I think it's probably one of the most illustrative examples of imagining that you are stuck, because there are so many variables that factor into a domestic violence situation, including, I mean, this is my, I guess, perspective on it, including that there's an arc that that dynamic has to fulfill, right? And if you are still in it, there's probably a very good reason, right? And the readiness to leave is something that, especially when outside eyes are gazing upon the situation, can feel pressurized. But there are all of these preparatory steps you're referencing that would be necessary to engage once you've even decided that your choice is to leave. So do you kind of marinate in the uncertainty? Do you sort of like open yourself to divine inspiration? Do you just follow like the littlest teeny yeses, the littlest teeny impulses as they arise to your awareness? Like, what was that like? Because everybody looking on to that situation would say, go, 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 go. You're not stuck. You just go. You go with the clothes on your back and you figure it out. And there are reasons that that is not actually what typically happens, right? That there is a long, for many women, marinating period before there is the readiness to actually extricate. And that has logistical, you know, factors. There are emotional, there are trauma-informed, you know, details. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that particular process, because maybe that's, yeah, the best way to see what this movement towards choice actually looks like, even when it seems like all the choices are shit.
Really, it's so real. And I don't think you need to make the decision. I don't really think, looking back, that I made a definitive decision to leave. It was more crawling through the sludge, one micro yes at a time. And the thing about micro yeses is, because they're so insignificant looking, it's a baby step cut into 1,000 pieces. You're not going to cause any ripples. There's not a micro yes makes a micro mess. So if you do a micro yes and you don't like the direction that you're going, you haven't made any decisions. It's sort of like running an experiment. So let's just, I didn't decide to leave. And this wasn't conscious. This was, in retrospect, what I was doing. I'm not ready to make any decisions about anything, but like, let's play a game. Let's run an experiment where I'm going to find out how much it would cost to live. I'm going to find out if there are any therapists I can see. I'm just going to see what it would be like. And wondering about a possibility is a lot easier of a lift than making a decision. And so whether it's something heavy like domestic violence or something like changing your career or moving to a new city or whatever, we have to make room for wonder, because there's physiological implications to that. You can wonder with your front brain on. When you're making a decision, often you can go into that amygdala overwhelm where you go into fight, flight, freeze, and then you're not going to go anywhere. Then you're going to shame yourself for not doing anything, which is going to release cortisol. And then we're off to the races with stuckness. Wonder is sort of the opposite of stuckness. If you can create space for, I wonder what, I wonder if, I wonder how, versus why. I really detest the why questions when we're in the midst of stuck. I get why is important. We've made our careers off of understanding the whys of humanity. But when you're stuck in a habit or a relationship or a financial mess, why am I here is not really a first line defense. If my office caught on fire right now, you are not going to say to me, Britt, why is your office on fire? You're going to say, bye, get out. And so we don't want to ask why questions when we're running little experiments. It's not why am I like this? It's what is my micro yes that I can do? I wonder what my little step might be. So wondering what and how and who is going to do more for us than wondering why or trying to make a definitive directional decision. That's too much for our brains.
So I want you to imagine what it would be like to never, ever be afraid of a symptom again, to be comfortable in your body, have easeful digestion, stable energy, to never need a doctor or prescriptions again, and to learn the language of your body so that you can read your yes and your no and trust your intuition. The truth is that you already have the power to heal anxiety, resolve depression, and to put an end to all of the enduring effects of stress. I'm Dr. Kelly Brogan, an Ivy League trained clinical psychiatrist who once believed so much in the conventional model of medicine that I specialized in prescribing to pregnant and breastfeeding women until I was diagnosed with my first potentially chronic illness and I decided to find a way out. And what I learned was how to walk through a life crisis and into your power. Since then, I have published many history-making cases of others doing the same through my 44-day health reclamation program, Vital Mind Reset. And I've learned that despite what I was taught in medical school, your lifestyle choices do matter, and you can make chronic illness a thing of the past. You can also disrupt patterns of struggle in your relationships and in your lifescape through an intentional reset. No deprivation, gadgets, supplements, doctors, healers, or gurus required. I'd love to invite you to my free Calm Body, Clear Mind Masterclass, where you will learn three quick win steps that you can take today to ease anxiety, resolve brain fog, and restore your energy, inspired by my Vital Mind Reset program. Comment below to check it out. So what is the point then? Because we explore these sort of like covert intentions and this like secret need meeting of a lot of codependency dynamics that I know you're super versed in, as am I. I have like a graduate level expertise.
Not
from a single institution, right? Because at some point to recognize that this is working, even if it sucks, is sobering. Right. It really is to see like this seems to be a huge problem, but it's actually functional. It's working. I've heard you talk about addiction in these terms, and I couldn't possibly agree more because the taboo and what I would call like erotic life force energy that gets bound up in the shame-fueled rejection of what it is that you're doing is the addiction itself, right? The whole thing just dissolves when you can take the piss out of it and just see it as like neutral. So I know you're thinking in these terms, right? Like this seems bad, but you also are, it's working and maybe you're getting something out of it. What's the right timing to explore that? It's not when you're in the midst of feeling trapped. It's not when you're feeling at this crossroads. It's not when you're, you know, sort of mired in choice paralysis. Is it later? Is it, you know, is it just sort of an interesting framework that helps us to move through the world differently? How do you see that as being helpful to people?
I love that you just said, you know, like, what are you getting out of this? And I have gotten so much heat with that question. Because if you tell someone who's being abused, what do you get?
Victim shaming.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And my answer to that is, number one, I've been there, done that, have the concert t-shirt. I'm not victim blaming. There, if we can take the good, bad binary of morality off of it and actually look at objectively what's going on here, and I'll speak for myself, I won't say for everyone. This is why I have a whole chapter in my first book about the hidden benefits of stuckness. This is not a shame exercise, nor is it justification. It's just, what am I getting out of being in this relationship? All behavior is functional. Not all behavior is healthy or safe or optimal, but it's serving a purpose. It's doing a job. For me, one of the many jobs my codependent abusive relationship served was, as long as my partner was bad, I could be good. Because I was obsessed with, I have to be the good person. And so I need a bad person. If you're going to be a good person, you need a bad person in order to have that state of goodness. And so when we pursue goodness at the expense of wholeness, we're going to get stuck somewhere. Stuckness will show up anywhere we're invested in the I'm a good person. I'm not saying do bad things. I'm saying we all have characters in our heads that are good and bad and morally reprehensible and neutral and chaotic. And that's human. That's just being human. Behaviors can be good and bad. Let's start with all parts are there to try to help. And so when I understood, and I didn't understand this till later, but I also didn't have anybody helping me. So I think it's helpful if you have a compassionate witness who can skillfully and lovingly guide you. And that can be a podcast, a book, a therapist, it could be anything. So like gently, like with love, sweet human, what might be the benefit of this? Because if we can understand, not why, but what's the benefit, can help us find that elsewhere. When I realized I needed to be good, that's when parts work and shadow work and all of that wonderful depth psychology stuff was really useful, because then I could accept my wholeness without investing in the goodness. And that made room for humanity like mine.
Couldn't agree more. And you also expose, you know, the tiny wizard behind the curtain, right? Because otherwise your behavioral compulsions are driven by invisible forces and you don't have awareness of the upside of staying stuck and not changing. And maybe even also the downside of the change that you purport to desire or seek. Yeah. So we've talked about this sort of, I don't know, for lack of a better word, dramatic situation where your higher self is offering you a path out and you're trying to figure out what that could possibly look like. And you're trying to get all your parts on board so that you can move in a certain direction. What happens when people just, because I hear this sometimes, and I know some folks in my personal life who struggle with this, and it's so unrelatable to me because I'm a double Gemini. I'm like very sort of like, oh, shiny object, you know, syndrome. What happens when you just don't feel any sort of pull, any sort of interest, you don't feel inclined to have, you know, necessarily any particular hobbies? You have no idea like what job would be interesting. Like I know somebody who's like coming off of alimony, for example, and later in life, and she's never really worked and she has no idea what should, would, could do. There's nothing ignited. Right. So in that kind of desiccated, you know, landscape, is it the same, like just feel for the tiny little yes and move in that direction? Or does it have any sort of nuance different than when you're trying to make the hard choice make sense for you?
I could argue that that's a harder situation because at least in a capital T trauma situation, you can kind of see what's going on. When everything is just sort of fine and meh, blah, nothing sounds interesting and nothing really feels good, but nothing's really that bad. That one is a tough one. And so I would say the first step, if you're in that situation where things are fine, we have to start with the assumption that you're not going to feel it. Like desire is a really overrated thing to shoot for when you're in neutral. So motivation or passion or purpose or that spark of inspiration, that is not a good thing to shoot for when you are shut down and feeling nothing. I'm with you. I'm like, I want to follow all the sparks. But the state of shutdown that you're describing, I've found, especially with the parts work framework, the idea that we have infinite aspects to ourselves, all of whom have opinions and jobs to do and roles to play and belief systems and reward systems. I would start with, let's not try to find what you love. Let's figure out what's needed here. Like, how much money do you need to live? Let's start with the assumption that as a mammal, you do need hobbies and humans. Like, you may not want to do them and you might be fine doing nothing, but you're not, because science. So then it's less, what do you want to do, and more, what are you willing to do? What's the easiest thing to sign up for? I don't care if you like it. I don't care if you're interested in it, because a step in the wrong direction will get you further faster than doing nothing, waiting for the perfect inspiration.
So just movement of some variety.
Do anything. Join a pottery class. Take a walk. Hug a tree. Doesn't matter. Because if you do the wrong thing, quote wrong, like tongue in cheek, wrong, that will give you feedback. It's sort of like in your car, your GPS system isn't going to tell you anything till you start driving. If you make a wrong turn, it'll recalculate. But if you sit and park in your driveway, it's not going to do anything. And our minds are the same. We have to generate feedback in order to know which direction to move. But you can't do that if you're doing nothing.
Yeah. When I was in my Kundalini yoga training, there was one of the teachings was, it was a quote, I think, from Yogi Bhajan, and it was, start and the pressure will be off. And I just think about that, right? Because as somebody who's, I probably err on the more impulsive side of starting before considered a contemplation. And I can also see how just, I love that GPS analogy, actually, it's perfect, because just some movement, yeah, it allows for the part that insists on perfection only and contributes that to the paralytic dynamic to maybe be reassigned another role. You talk about motivation, so the myth of motivation. And I wonder, because right in that scenario, there seems to be an absence of motivation. And you could even get into the sort of psychiatric pathological realm and see that as diagnostic of some sort of, you know, core imbalance, or however they characterize things these days. And I've heard you say that you don't actually find motivation to be a necessary ingredient for change. Whereas to me, that is such a powerful statement, because most of us are waiting for motivation, or we characterize ourselves as unmotivated or undisciplined. And what is the role, do you think, of motivation in this kind of movement?
So the way motivation is commonly described, when I say we don't need it, that's sort of what I mean. Like this feeling of instinctual desire to move in a direction, like the thing that gives you the, I want to get up and get off the couch, and now I'm getting up and off the couch. We don't need it. Like, you don't need to feel anything to do anything. You don't have to feel like it. And any parents who've raised humans know, like, how often do your kids feel like going to bed, brushing their teeth, taking a bath, going to school, doing the homework? This idea that we have to feel something to do something is a myth that keeps us perpetually stuck. So that's one side. The other side is I can make a case for there's no such thing as unmotivation. It's just you're either motivated by comfort, you're motivated by familiarity, or you're motivated to mobilize in a direction of your choosing. But it's a myth that you can be unmotivated. It's more like, well, which part of you is driving the car and what's their motivation? If I'm laying on the couch binge watching White Lotus, that's because I'm motivated by numbing out. I'm not being motivated by pursuing a passion. And so, like, we're always motivated, but the feeling that people describe is often the thing that happens after you move, not the thing that gets you moving. Motivation is a function of doing things, not the thing that inspires movements, unless you're really fortunate. I don't know those people.
Yeah. I mean, it's very relatable. And, you know, I've chosen, I guess, to parent in a certain way relative to this, because I was raised with a lot of extrinsic motivation, shall we say. And the disconnection that is engendered by a lot of dominant culture, and if we want to call it conventional parenting, is to really make it impossible for us to sense whatever our internal drive actually even is, right? So we have all of these shoulds that are coming from somewhere out there, and we don't know, other than that I'd rather not do anything, right? What's actually happening inside? I mean, I encounter this on a micro level pretty much every day, because I do some kind of movement every day. And I go to a lot of classes, like dance classes and whatever. I love these classes. Like, I am voluntarily, electively going, okay? Nobody's making me. I often haven't, you know, it's not like I've invested already in advance or something like that. I want to go. And there's just like a half an hour period before almost every single one where I'm like, I don't know, maybe not today. Maybe I need to rest. Maybe it's important to just chill and do less. And I do it anyway, because there's what I call a little yes. There's just underneath all that confusion and noise and all the parts bickering is this tiny like, yep, go, we want to go. And sometimes it's the opposite, where there's just like a tiny like, meh, forget it. And there's like, well, but you should, and it's important on top, right? So do you think that there is, I don't know, some kind of channel that we can open to connect to our intuition on that level? How do you imagine it's best for people to navigate, you know, these little micro decisions that we make every day, to do nothing and stay still, or to do something, like literally, as we were saying, anything, any action, any movement in any direction?
I love that question so much, because it really dismantles this idea that you have to have a full body yes or else it's a hell no. Because all of the big things I've ever done, the scary, big, fun things, were not full body yeses. Like, even coming on a podcast. Like, there's always a little voice that says, but she's really smart. You're going to sound like an idiot. Like, that's not imposter syndrome. I hate that we've pathologized our humanity by calling it a syndrome. And you're nodding because I know you know this too. Every person from every level of success I've ever met has a little, but what if you suck voice? And so let's start with the full body yes is great in no. Like not always and hardly ever for a lot of people. The framework that I use for this dilemma is the parts work approach. The idea that your mind is a multiple house of characters, all of whom have different motivations, none of whom are evil or out to get you. So if we start with the assumption, your brain is on your side, even the most shadowy, not healthy, objectively not good parts of you are trying to help you do your human incarnation. And if you don't talk to them, and this sounds weird, but we all think to ourselves every day, parts work suggests that how about it's a conversation and not a decree? Because the part of me that doesn't want to do the thing, it might be that that part just needs me to recognize, yeah, you know what? She's really scary. You're not. But like, what if I just validate, like, you're awesome. But what if I just validate, you know what? It is kind of scary to talk to someone that we respect and who is so intelligent. And it's probably a little bit true that we're going to sound like a jackass, but it's not all the way true. And I will be here with you, little parts, in this thing, so you won't be alone. If we could actually speak to ourselves, with ourselves, and have a dialogue instead of this internal monologue, life works a lot better. Because a good parent or a good coach doesn't coddle, but also doesn't berate and browbeat. A good coach knows when to push and when to pull and when to encourage and when to, all right, like, we're getting in this thing, no more discussion about it. And we wonder why our minds are running around wildly, but if we don't talk to the parts of ourselves or listen to them, of course it's not going to go well. Even high-level athletes need coaches and kids need parents. Our voices in our head also need an inner leader.
So there's one tool that you can find lying out and about in my house any time of day, and that is the Sonic Slider. It's a highly calibrated tuning fork developed by my friend and bioenergetic and sound healing pioneer, Eileen McCusick. It delivers a deep, penetrating, very specific vibration that tones your body from the inside out. I think of it as like harmonizing and organizing anything that I apply it to. So it works on fascia, lymph, and subtle energy, of course. And it unwinds tension, it boosts circulation, vitality, and coherence in your electric body, which, by the way, is where it's at, in case you haven't heard. I use it on my face, actually, to lift and brighten. And I use it on my joints if I have any post-workout inflammation or pain. And then also on my midline to harmonize my nervous system. And every night before bed, I vibrate it on my third eye just because it feels good. So this is one of those tools that bridges science and soul in the way that only Eileen knows how to. It's super simple to use. You literally just tap it and then gently hold it anywhere that you want to apply it. And it feels amazing. So use code Kelly Brogan at biofieldtuningstore.com for 15% off your first purchase. And it also happens to be one of my favorite gifts to give people. I just love that you've come to parts work the same way that I have. I mean, I'm like a zealot about it because it is one of the only ways that I have seen, family constellation is another, but to truly move beyond the dialectic of the good, bad, victim, you know, driving triangle is when you can recognize the benevolent intention of every single part and also know when you are blending with one in contrast to another. But most of these parts, as I know you'll agree, they just want to hear and feel like, I see you. I know this is hard. I'm right here with you. Right? That's it. It's like this kind of, you know, they call it capital S self, this kind of presence that we can bring as really the good parent, but without sort of that, even that much agenda. So when you come to view human behavior through the lens of parts work, the whole construct of mental illness and psychological, psychiatric pathology necessarily shifts. So I wonder if we could go there a little bit and talk about, yeah, how you came to study and learn the DSM rubric and how you moved away from it and what you actually think about so-called mental illness these days, especially as informed by your parts work perspectives.
And then Brit gets canceled. So perfect TM. But it's true. You know, my psychopathology professor in grad school called the DSM the doorstop manual because he said the only thing it's good for is holding the door open. And again, disclaimer for everyone listening, we need the DSM for access to services and healthcare. And as a framework for categorizing symptoms, it can be useful. That's like my very generous, like, I get it. It's not perfect. But here's the analogy that I give. And it goes with this pathology thing. If my car's check engine light goes on and I take my car to a mechanic and I say, my car's check engine light is on, they're not going to say to me, well, your check engine light is on, so you have check engine light disorder. That's insane sounding, right? Like, that's, everyone laughs when I say that because it sounds so ridiculous. But if you go to a therapist and say, I have anxiety, now you have anxiety disorder. If I go to a doctor with bipolar symptoms, now I have bipolar disorder. So the symptoms are signals. I'm not suggesting people don't suffer, and I'm not suggesting that there are symptoms that are debilitating to the point of being life-threatening, like, obviously. But what the traditional mental health model, which is antiquated and politicized, and it comes from a group of very select group of men from the 50s, that model assumes that all of the symptoms that make us human are what make us broken. Women were given lobotomies and called hysterical for having orgasms. So, like, I'm not saying we're not suffering. I'm saying what we call mental illness is often a reasonable response to trauma, a reasonable response to the chaotic nature of living with access to everyone everywhere, where brains were never evolved to know everything about everyone everywhere. And then we wonder what's wrong. It's like, obviously you're suffering, but it's not what's my diagnosis. It's what's my injury. Symptoms are always clues. They are not the end zone, but we stop with the symptoms as if that were the full story. Yes, manage the symptoms in whatever ways make sense. And symptoms are storytellers. They're not little demons out to derail us. And this idea that anxiety attacks us, all of these war metaphors, right? We battle addiction. We fight depression. We have to kill our ego and banish our critic. Like, holy crap. And we wonder why we feel bonkers half the time. What if we called a ceasefire and learned to connect with these different symptom carriers and storytellers inside us and understand what's going on for you? What are our options for helping to unburden you? And the parts work model that I'm trained in that we're sort of referencing is internal family systems, Dr. Richard Schwartz. The model is amazing. I went rogue with it in my new book. And it's sort of like IFS's like scrappy, sassy little cousin. But it makes so much, all pathology makes sense in context. And I know you've seen this. I've worked with severe and persistent mental illness, inpatient hospital stuff. And if you read the case file, it's not hard to see how we got from point A to in the hospital. Why is it not referred to as an injury or a response instead of just, this is who you are and this is your disorder and your disease? So that's my very long rant on, I do not use a pathological model. Symptom categorization is useful, but disorder, disease, who said this? Was it Viktor Frankl? Someone said, I don't remember who, that, you know, insanity is a reasonable response to an insane world.
It's interesting to apply, you know, because I woke up, if we want to call it that, after I was already leaving the system and entering into private practice. So I didn't have to live in two worlds for very long, you know, on the locked units in Bellevue Hospital, and then also, you know, exploring reparenting and shadow work. Like, I didn't have to live in that, you know, fugue state. And it's interesting to apply the lens of adaptive response to injury to even the most extreme and dramatic expressions of psychosis or, you know, any sort of perceptual disturbance or suicidality, et cetera. And I wonder, you know, when you work with somebody, is there a manifestation of symptoms that you feel is like beyond, as long as the person is motivated and willing, let's say, that you feel is like beyond this perspective? It's like, that's too much. That's something that, you know, needs management, needs regulation. Or do you really believe, as I do, I'll just put that out there, that when there is a readiness on the part of a given human who's had an experience to integrate these fragments, there's always a way to trace it back and to reclaim, you know, these experiences of the past. Like, do you think that trauma is a driver in all of these cases of what we are otherwise calling mental illness? Or do you think sometimes it's like a chemical imbalance? Sort of a loaded question. There's the right answer. No, I'm kidding.
If I haven't gotten canceled yet, like, okay, like we're going to eliminate the rest of the people now. So the problem is that understanding the function of a symptom doesn't excuse the behavior that manifests as a result. And so I'm not suggesting that people stay in narcissistically abusive relationships because they're so blended with their protectors and they're just trying to, like, no, you know, someone who's blended with a part who does killings, like, we should hold people accountable. And I am not suggesting we live in this chaotic, enabling, pseudo-compassionate world of just let everyone do whatever they're going to do because everything is a function of trauma or parts. No. With that said, I do believe that often when we say people can't change, assuming we don't have some sort of cognitive or medical dementia, I don't think that you can parts work here. I mean, maybe someday that'll be proven to be untrue, and I hope so. But I'm making room for, yes, there are certain medical things, brain structural things that would impede parts work from being useful. But often when people say they can't change, what that means is they won't change. Because given access to the right resources, relative safety, and the willingness to explore in a skillful container, most people, when they say they can't change, it's not because they can't. It's because the behaviors are being enabled to the point where change is not necessary. Narcissism being the chief of this. When I hear people say narcissists can't change, it's like, well, first of all, I think of narcissism as a process addiction and not as a personality disorder. It's a pattern of behavior that persists despite negative consequences and grows in severity despite all evidence being that this is objectively bad. But we have too many personalities to use the binary of normal or disordered. So narcissism and what we call cluster B personality disorders in the mental health world, I think of those as process addictions because they're enabled. The behaviors persist. But even the most ragingly out of control narcissist, if they wanted to, again, assuming there's no brain impairment there, could if they chose to. So when we say they can, often we mean they won't. And so, yes, I do believe that with the right set of resources, which may or may not involve chemical assistance of a variety of sorts, psychedelics or whatever, like, yeah, the capacity for humans to change is there. We know that from neuroplasticity. So can't is often won't, or doesn't need to, or can't have, or doesn't have access to. But yeah, people can change.
And when you look at your trajectory and you look at the ways that you personally have changed, what would you characterize as like the signature nature of that change? Like, for example, in my case, I've spent, you know, the better part of like 15 years on inner work and exploration, self-development, all the things, much of which, by the way, was an elaborate avoidant strategy of the actual work, you know, right? Like looked like spiritual self-love and actually was yeah, complex avoidance. But nonetheless, I still have a lot of the same trauma-informed responses to the world, reactions. I even sometimes have the same somatic sequence of triggering. And the only difference, and I wonder if you would agree, the only real difference is that there's a pause, right? There's a pause inserted where I can exercise choice. And I can do often the more uncomfortable thing, or I think of it as courageous, you know, interpersonally, usually. And that's really how I've changed. So it's even hard to be in like a spiritual meritocracy where I say like, oh, I'm so much better now. I'm not sure that's the case. I just know that now I have this this little bandwidth where I can do a different thing than I used to do if I choose to. So when you look back on your journey, and I know you've had like a colorful, adventurous, wild magic carpet ride of an experience, would you say the same? Or do you think that you've like actually changed, like your whole trauma core has been, you know, melted down and rebuilt into a, you know, a gilded castle or something like that?
Oh, hell no. I really appreciate you teeing that up that way because I can already feel the angry DMs coming. When I say people can change, I mean their responses, not the structure of their psyche. So same, you adapted in a very healthy, like your complex avoidance took the form of a really useful, helpful, skillful undertaking. Mine showed up as borderline person, or what the mental health world classically calls borderline personality disorder, for almost 20 years. Just, I was such a, bless my heart and bless my parts, they were kind of assholes and like not super awesome. I mean, behaviorally, I've gotten to know them and they're delightful and I love them. But I love all my parts. But borderline personality quote disorder, also a process addiction in my view, is I was told this is who you are. This is not curable. And to a degree, they're right. But the thing is I no longer act out in rage. I no longer self-harm in that way. I no longer have high levels of impulsivity marked by recklessness and this and all the things in the DSM. But it's not that that changed, because I'm with you. I still have my full set of impulsive, reactive, emotional, illogical, whatever. But now there's someone in charge of the group. And now I understand who's in charge of which things and who's getting, it's not why am I triggered, it's who's getting triggered. And so with me, my capital S self at the center, those parts have someone to help them. So I don't need to act out compulsively and repetitively the same pattern. You know, when I said symptoms are storytellers, we will act out in this grand theatrical way, whatever story our parts are needing to be witnessed. So I think of addiction sort of this very shadowy, deadly form of performance art. It's unintentional, but the theater of performance art is to tell a story and create questions. And that's what addiction does. Yeah, I'm not advocating it. It's not like great. And I'm not saying people who do amazing performance art are at the same. I'm not saying everything is the same. I am saying addiction is a really interesting, unintentional form of performance art. And art demands that we listen and pay attention, not just shut it down because it's grotesque or it's unpleasant to look at. So that's a long-winded answer for I no longer manifest the symptoms of BPD and I am no longer dominated by reactivity and impulsivity in that way. But those parts are still there. I'm still a hot mess. It's just I have a loving, skillful, compassionate center for which the hot mess parts to settle and relax into. So yeah.
Explain in case people don't know what a process addiction means.
Yeah.
Because I know what you're saying. I actually love that phrase and I hadn't encountered it before you.
There's some debate over whether that's real, but like it is. So ask any gambling addict. So a chemical addiction is where you ingest a substance. So including food, anywhere you are and sex technically is an exchange of chemicals, you know, through someone's body or some other thing. A process addiction is where there's no ingestion of a chemical. So that would be gambling or shopping or video games or doom scrolling. So any habits that does not involve a chemical would be considered a process addiction. So a pattern of behavior and, you know, addiction defined a pattern of behavior that persists despite negative consequences, grows with increasing severity over time and persists despite it's bad, it's harmful. So often what we call addiction as a disease might be a process, which is an adaptation that will continue until the parts are taken care of. It's so interesting because in borderline classic, as I was classically trained, you know, one of the symptoms is this split, you know, internal splitting is considered pathological. I have found the more I split my psyche and understand all of the different parts, the better I feel and the more functional I am. I call it the paradox of wholeness. In order to feel whole, you have to separate all of the parts of your minds. Because if it's...
Well, you're unblending, right?
Exactly. Yes.
That's so true. I mean, for those listening who aren't familiar with, you know, the sort of psychiatric jargon we're throwing around, borderline personality disorder is classically taught to be the most I would say the most recidivistic, maybe, you know, if we're talking about like antisocial or whatever, but it, at least in my training, it was assumed that there isn't really a treatment. And, you know, you can kind of do some dialectical behavioral therapy, plus minus. I mean, this diagnosis was like one of the few that we didn't throw meds at typically. And I was in one of the most med forward institutions, you know, there is probably. I mean, it was just so pharmaceutically driven, my training. And the thought was just basically like they're help rejecting complainers. And I mean, we use these phrases, right? Help rejecting complainers. And there's really, yeah, they come in with their teddy bear to the inpatient unit and you just sort of like tolerate them. But everybody also kind of like loved them because they were so dramatic and funny and exciting and like had so much like joie de vivre coupled with like their suicidality. I mean, it was just, it's so much, honestly, now that I look at it through this, on like feminine energy, like truly uncontained feminine energy.
Men don't get that diagnosis very often.
Almost never. Yeah, almost never. So it's a fascinating, yeah, consideration, like as to explore what's actually being controlled through the psychiatric labeling of borderline. And I love hearing that it's almost like I could feel when you're saying it, your presence with these parts that are just protecting like your little squishy little girl, you know, exile. And it's, yeah, it's a very, it's easy to feel a kind of, you know, compassion. And I love what you're pointing out about process addiction, because there are so, I've heard you say, you know, you could have like a people-shaped substance, you know, like, right? Like, right. And, you know, there are so many of us who have, you know, walked the well-trodden path of codependency who would attest to the highly addictive nature of relational drama, right? And the insistence that we can help change, improve, guide, you know, and otherwise externalize our control to our partners so that we can finally feel loved. And I know for myself, like the arousal of conflict and the experience of conflict, you know, once I was entered into a celibate window, I would pursue it. I mean, I would drum up conflict with the guy fixing the roof and it was never sort of like angry stuff. It was just like, I would like subconsciously manifest some reason to have like an issue with the bill or whatever. And being a CEO, it's like it's like a playground for disappointment and resentment. And so if the meta addiction is to the arousal of conflict and that victim field of warfare that we were talking about earlier, then you'll find some other way, you know, to be a dry drunk even in your, you know, your sobriety process. So yeah, I've looked at sobriety in these past couple of years for me as being a very multifold landscape, you know, that's encompassed every dimension of things that I, you know, put into my body, and also dynamics that I engage. And I would say the hardest work I've done in my self-development journey has been to come into stability and peace and harmony. I mean, my life now could even be characterized as boring. And it's right. And there's been a kind of a sense of like a nihilistic part that comes up and says like, well, is this it? You know, I miss the the highs and lows. Yeah. And I know you can relate. You've called it the snow globe effect, right? Like you call it sort of like when you engage in the disruption that ends a certain pattern of stuckness and opens up a new vista. And as somebody who's been, yeah, veritably obsessed with pattern disruption, I mean, even my health program, Vital Mind Reset, I've literally described it that way, as like a pattern disruptor that lays new snow on the mountain. And what I've dissected around it, because I have been trying to analyze, like, why does it have this effect, is that you just, through the mundane choices that you commit to for a month, you understand that you have more choices than you thought you had. That's literally all that's happening. So I'd love to sort of close with just a little bit about this concept of pattern disruption and how, because I know you talk about from the like very almost weird and mundane to the, you know, the big picture, but how people can start to interact with pattern disruption as a means to resolve the perceived experience of stuckness.
So to bring this down to a simple, actionable, here's the thing you can do. Pattern disruption does not require intelligence, creativity, skill, or passion. All it requires is to do something that your brain's not expecting. And this is why I call it snow globing the brain. So citrus is my favorite way. Biting into a really sour lemon when you're procrastinating will disrupt your autopilot settings for probably about 2 to 3 seconds, just long enough for a choice window to open for you to do something else. Like keep a bowl of lemons or hot peppers if you enjoy lemons, or some aggressively uncomfortable, that's non-harmful sensory stimulus. Wasabi, you'll get it done. A warhead, whatever. Stick that in your mouth when
you're dating yourself with that reference.
I so am. I know. So yeah, I'm 45. I'm fully like X. I'm on the edge of XY. I'm not an elder millennial. I'm like a geriatric millennial looking in the millennial window. Let me in. So like put a really aggressive sensory input in your path when you're procrastinating. Like if you lay on your couch, have it on your coffee table, or when you're procrastinating on your computer, don't try to force yourself to do something. Just like pat yourself on the head 12 times. Anything that jump up and down on one foot, put your head on the other side of the bed. These are ridiculous. People said to me, like, Britt, this is stupid. And I know, but our brains also are really simple and literal. So it's not going to expect you to bite into a lemon. So when you do that, your choice window opens and it only takes 2 to 3 seconds between deadly choice that's going to ruin my life and non-deadly choice that might lead me on a path towards wholeness and freedom. And so we've got to open up the choice window, snow globing your brain. Just stick your head in a bucket of cold water. You don't need a cold plunge to do this. Like ice cubes down your back will do it. With your consent, don't do that to someone else. Nudge, nudge. See, I'm changing your tolerance and I'm opening up your change window. Don't do that. But anything you do, sensory stuff works the fastest, that disrupts the pattern of autopilot is going to create a change window and a choice window. And so you don't need to spend money. This stuff is free and available and takes no time at all. There's no reason not to do it. It's easier to do it than not to do it.
So people do want to spend money. How can they find support through your resources? I'd love for you to just share what you've amassed in terms of resources and, you know, what you've put together for folks who are interested and curious and have started to engage that sense of wonder. Like, I wonder what it might be like if, what do you got going on?
I love it. Thank you. So my first book, The Science of Stuck, and the workbook, I wrote a workbook to go with it. And it's a choose your own adventure, little path through. It's very self-led. You don't have to start it. Go start to finish. I designed it so you can dip in and out. I designed it for busy, I'm a former meth smoker. Like if you're like a go, 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 go person, it'll work. And if you're a I don't want to do any of the things person, it'll help. And then my new book is called Align Your Mind. And it's my take on parts work, heavily drawn from IFS, but in my own style. And it's really demystifying and taking parts work out of the therapeutic arena into the here's just a way you can approach everything in your life, from how you get dressed in the morning to what you eat for breakfast to whatever. And that is available for pre-order now.
Amazing. I am super excited for that because there are not a lot of folks that I feel have asked enough questions when it comes to the mental health arena in the parts work world. And you're such a gift to this mission and this exploration. And I'm so grateful to have you as an ally. So thank you, Britt.
Thank you.